A few years ago at a sidewalk sale, I acquired a large book of Edward Curtis's photographs of North American Native peoples, which he'd taken in the late 19th and early 20th century. And I returned to this book periodically just to meditate with the mystery and poignancy of these photographs and to gaze into the inscrutable faces of the subjects. At the turn of the 20th century, North America's traditional indigenous cultures were rapidly disintegrating. Many tribes were barely recognizable remnants of their former selves. They'd been uprooted from their lands and subjected to both overt and underhanded assault for over two centuries. And so Curtis recognized the urgency of documenting their presence before it was too late. So traveling across North America, he took 40,000, some 40,000 photographic images of over 80 tribes. He made over 10,000 wax cylinder recordings of native languages and music. He recorded tribal lore and history, described traditional foods, housing, garments, recreation, ceremonies, and funeral customs. He wrote biological sketches of the tribal leaders. In later times, his methods were to some extent criticized, such as his practice of paying his subjects to don their traditional garments and pose that way in ways that expressed a romanticized or anachronistic picture of their culture rather than reflecting their actual conditions at the time, which were often squalid and much infiltrated by white Western society. Nevertheless, his material in most cases is the only recorded history of these communities and cultures other than the oral histories that the people themselves continue to pass on. And so to gaze at these photographs is to witness portraits of loss and grief and bitter suffering, as much as to witness portraits of dignity and majesty, spiritual power, and traditional artistry. So one afternoon, a few months ago, I was looking through this book when my attention was captured by the photograph that appears on the cover of the leaflet today. For the first time, I took notice of the caption, "Kuskomo person wearing full-body fur garment, oversized gloves, and mask of hami, meaning dangerous thing, during the Numlim ceremony." Dangerous thing. I mused. Dangerous thing? It's the Kuskomo version of the boogeyman. It's the personification of that which terrifies. We all have our personal experience of the terrifying thing that lurks in the shadows of our personal world, or of our conscience, or of our consciousness. And we all have our cultural collective forms of personified terror, both the old forms from the folk tales and contemporary forms that loom out at us from the news. And so Hami, dangerous thing, became an icon for me at a time when I was going through a period of intense and nameless anxiety, when I was finding myself struggling with a great deal of existential dread that seemed much bigger than the situations that were triggering it. And I would say to myself, it's Hami visiting you, the dangerous thing spooking you. And this would help me to withdraw my projection from the situation and look at what was going on for me inside my own psyche, my own heart and mind. Well, after quite a bit of investigation, I've been unable to find any further references to Hami or the Numlim dance or even very much about the Kuskomo tribe. And this may be one of those occasions where Curtis's record is the only one that survives. And so because I haven't been able to learn more about this particular character, I can't confirm whether, in fact, it is a boogeyman-type personification or how Hami functioned in the ritual and dance and psychology of the culture of the tribe. Anything I speculate about that is going to be absolute speculation. But I am going to proceed on an assumption that Hami, dangerous thing, was some kind of spook, And I'm going to make a leap to another tribal culture that I have been able to learn a little bit more about. I first read about the Booger Dance of the Cherokee people in a novel, The 13 Moons, by Charles Frazier, who's also the author of Cold Mountain, which some of you may be familiar with. Both novels are set in North Carolina in the Civil War era. So remembering the spooky, goofy play of the Cherokee Booger Dance described in 13 Moons, I wondered if my hunch might be correct about what the dance is getting at. The Booger Dance is a living tradition for the Cherokee, usually performed in the autumn or the winter. The boogers shuffle clumsily into the dance circle, swathed in blankets and quilts, wearing masks made of large gourds or hornets' nests or wood burls. What they may have looked like centuries ago, we cannot know. But by the 19th century, the boogers often began to resemble grotesque and clownish versions of the people of the European settlers that the tribal people encountered. So the boogers may have long sausage-like noses or bushy eyebrows over bug eyes or crossed eyes, fur mustaches. Some have bald heads. Some have large protruding ears, big crooked teeth, and leering grins or snarls. The boogers are both spooks and clowns. So in the context of the ceremony, they begin by displaying all kinds of absurd and ribald and playfully threatening antics. They lunge after and try to grab the little children who run away shrieking and giggling. They grope lustily after the women. They make obscene gestures and flatulent noises. They bump into each other and fall over. And then it's time for the host or the master of the ceremony to engage them in conversation. And he asks them who they are and why they're here and where they've come from. And they whisper their answers to him, and the host translates to the crowd, including the boogers' non sequiturs and jokes. And the audience jeers and laughs and questions and teases them. And then each of the boogers is called by name, and the names are too obscene to be repeated from the pulpit here. And each has a chance to do his own special booger dance, revealing his particular character. But an intriguing part of the evening comes when the women in the audience, the women of all ages, the young ones, the young nubile women, all the way up to the aged women, they are called to dance with the boogers, with the spooks. And they do dance with them, sometimes side by side, sometimes face to face, sometimes in mock sexual burlesque, sometimes with a certain dignity. But they dance with the spooks and accept them as partners. Now, this dance is a bit of wild fun, as is Halloween. But it served a much more serious purpose in older times, as did Halloween. But nevertheless, either way, whether we're looking at its ancient or contemporary forms, it has the purpose of giving the people an opportunity to personify and interact with the threats and adversities and the stresses that they have to struggle with. And using jest and mockery, they reduce those threats to something psychologically manageable. So the boogers also represent lost or repressed aspects of the people themselves. The actors, the dancers, can express the offending behaviors with impunity for one night. The old men recovering their lustiness, the young men taking on the characteristics of wizened old age, the tribal leaders able to act like fools. The connection between terror and clowning shows up in other cultures. For example, the Hopi boogeyman character is the great and terrifying Kuchina spirit, Kavayo, who is a kind of ogre. And anyone who doesn't uphold his obligations in the tribal community, shirking work or transgressing in other ways, will get their comeuppance from Chavayo. And yet in the tribal dances, Chavayo in particular is always hounded by a pack of sacred clowns who badger him and relentlessly tease him. So the most terrifying character in the tribe has this accompanying entourage of clowns that interacts with it. So fear has its place, but it has to be kept in perspective. Now, the term booger or booger dance is not traditional or original to the Cherokee language, but is borrowed from European culture and, in fact, is a reference to the boogeyman. And when I looked into this name, this term, the idea of the boogeyman, it's incredible how widespread and how universal it is. I mean, virtually every culture across the planet has something like the boogeyman or the boogeywoman. Something, and this suggests that it represents something essentially human, something universally human. And often this personification of terror has the role of frightening children into behaving. So it's a tool for getting, for social control is one of the reasons why it exists. Well, what are its characteristics? It's often amorphous, it has no specific form. Although depending on the local culture, it may be rumored to have some particular ghastly feature or some particular ghastly behavior. And it always lurks in the dark places, wherever they may be found, in the woods, in the basement, under the bed, in the attic, in a local cave, in an abandoned well or building. And it comes after you if you do something that you shouldn't do. And it does terrible, terrible things to you. It grabs you and takes you to its lair and it crunches on your bones. Now, we may not believe anymore in the boogeyman per se, but we all retain that experience of a diffuse, nameless, faceless threat. The thing at the bottom of our brains that really scares us. And when we aren't paying attention, we can project that dangerous thing onto people or onto situations around us and transform those people or those situations into boogeymen that rob us of our freedom. Another derivation of the idea is the Celtic malevolent fairy called the boggart. The boggart's minimum mischief is that it causes things to disappear, or for milk to sour, or for dogs to go lame. It's said that the boggart crawls into people's beds at night and puts a clammy hand on their faces. Sometimes the boggart strips the sheets off them in the middle of the night or will pull on a person's ears. I guess that's not too serious a danger. But interestingly, the boggart attaches itself to a family or to an individual and will follow the victim wherever that family or person tries to go. Sound familiar? The mythology of the boggart is expanded in J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. And in her telling, the boggart is a shapeshifter who finds some dark and closed place to huddle. And when an unsuspecting soul encounters or startles it, it immediately assumes the form of that which is most utterly terrifying to the poor individual. And so, what is the charm that is used to dispel or ward off the boggart? I know there's people who know this. Ridiculous! So one concentrates upon something quite absurd and silly and projects the thought onto the boggart, exclaiming, get your wands out, ridiculous! So the boggart will find itself in Snoopy dog underwear or roller skates or some other such nonsense and will be immediately robbed of its capacity to terrorize. And what's the other thing that keeps to keep in mind when wrestling with the terror of the boggart? Don't do it alone. Take a friend with you, or take several friends, because the boggart is confused when trying to respond to multiple people's psyches at the same time, and so it will shape-shift itself into knots. So whether you are a Harry Potter fan or not, this is sound advice. When you're struggling with something terrifying, keep a sense of humor, and let your friends help you. Well, that said, I cannot say that that's exactly the advice or the process that I followed a few months ago when I was struggling to make a very serious decision. During the summer and into the fall, just this past summer and fall, I was really racked with a deep struggle about my decision about when to complete my tenure with this congregation. And I was torn excruciatingly between my sense of commitment to the congregation and my inner needs to move forward in my life. And I could not see my way clear to meet both of these concerns. And interestingly and oddly, at the same time that this was going on for me, I found myself struggling with intense and groundless and often paralyzing anxiety that hounded me through my days. And this was the time when I came across the photograph of Hami, The Dangerous Thing. And I began to contemplate why the boogeyman was following me about. And then one day it finally dawned on me that underneath my aching concerns about how to do right by the congregation and my longing to proceed forward in my personal and professional life, underneath all of that, that tension between those two things was making it impossible for me to really do much of anything. And underneath all of that was one big truth. And that was that I was afraid to face everything that I would lose if I left Theodore Parker Church. And so this one day, I just started naming everything that I would lose. People I love, a place of creative expression, the beauty of what happens here in the sanctuary and in other places in our communal life, the joy and playfulness and purposefulness of our relationships, a professional identity, a personal identity, a job, an income, stability, security, and even the home that Tom and I share and have loved living in for all these years, because it's most likely that we will need to leave the neighborhood once I finish my work at Theodore Parker. I knew that once I was to go public with my intention to go, that I would set in motion a whole set of emotional reactions and congregational processes that I would have little or no control over. And I knew that that represented a frightening loss for me as well. And so that day, as I began naming all these things, I was soon in a puddle of tears. And I cried all day long. And I have been doing a lot of crying ever since. But the mystery is that once I turned and faced and danced with the boogeyman, once I took the dangerous thing into my arms and danced with it, then very quickly the anxiety and the paralyzing indecision dissipated, and it became very clear what I needed to do. And thus I wrote my letter to you, and I began the process of making my decision public to depart in June. In my life, I've had to face many things that were quite terrifying, as we have all had to do. There's not a single one of us who has escaped that. But those terrible things are, as the old folk tales tell us, guardians of our power. They hold a gift. They hold a prize. And when we can face the monster, when we can look the frightening element in the face, we can even dance with it. It gives us back some crucial piece of ourselves. It gives us a piece of our power that we had formerly abdicated, conceded. It gives us our freedom. Because fear is a captor and an oppressor. And courage is a liberator. So the gift that fear takes from us is freedom. And we win that back when we can be courageous. And of course, courage is not the absence of fear at all. It's just the willingness to engage what has to be faced, even though we're frightened. As William Blake said it, it is right, and it is so. We were made for joy and woe. And when this we rightly know, safely through the world we go. So perhaps a better word for safely is courageously and freely through the world we go. When we can dance courageously with our fears, we are free to move through the world, facing the challenges before us and seeking the fullness of life of which we are capable. And may it be so for all of us. Well, I struggled to find a hymn that would speak to this. And this may not be a perfect fit, but it expresses a blessing for the congregation. May nothing evil cross this door. So may we sing it together and remember, especially in the last line, that laughter is a healing balm. So let's please.